So, good evening. So this is the beginning of the Transforming Problems module in Discovering Buddhism. Those of you who, how many of you have never been to a Discovering Buddhism class before? Well, okay. That's fine, by the way. it's a course that, has 13 modules in it, 12 modules, and the 13th one is actually practice. So, but still, there's 13 modules in it, and it usually takes about 3 years, I guess, to cover all the modules, something like that. And so this is the one called Transforming Problems. And my name is Shankar Mitra, so I've been coming here for a long time, and even before that I've been going to other centers for many years before that. So, let's see. To start, why don't we just at least to begin with do a short meditation, so that, or at least short breathing meditation, to kind of bring ourselves to the present, because you know I'm sure we've had a hectic day, right? Beginning of the week and so forth and so on. So let's bring our minds to rest. So if you've been attending the center and you've been coming to Geshe Lo's teachings on Sunday mornings, you may know about the 9-round breathing meditation. So you can do that using his instructions, right? Or if you don't know how to do that, then His Holiness Dalai Lama has a technique that he recommends to students, and that is very simple, actually. It's 3 breaths deep into our bellies and then out. So 3 like that. And as we take the breaths, we imagine that with each out breath, the stresses and the strains of the day kind of just flow out, right? Or sometimes, you know, like a visualization, like, you know, if you're under a shower and all the dirt kind of just washes off, so kind of like that, all the stresses and strains just kind of wash off of us. So whatever works for you, something like that with the 3 breaths, and then we can just do a short meditation on the breath. And there are people, where's the camera? Over there. There's people, hello there. Welcome. I always mean to do this before every one of these classes, but I never do it. So it's been years, and I keep forgetting, so I'm glad I did remember today. Okay, so why don't we start with our short meditation. So let's consider how fortunate that we are to be in our present circumstances, however, whatever difficulties we might be going through. We have a very precious human life with which we have the capacity to discriminate, to think, to judge, to consider the result of our actions, make choices, good choices. Not every being in this planet has that ability. So it's a very precious thing that we have, the qualities that we have. That we have we have the mental faculty to be able to understand the teachings, to understand the correct interpretation, to analyze, to meditate. That we have the time, we have the energy. That we even have the interest. That our basic needs are taken care of so that we have the luxury to be able to engage in these activities. So, in many, many ways, we are extremely fortunate to be here. So the Buddha said that this body and this combination of body and mind that we have right now is what is necessary to attain liberation and enlightenment. The gods don't have this ability. The animals and the other beings in the other realms don't have this ability. So it's truly an amazing gift that we have. So we must use every moment in the best way possible to be of benefit to ourselves and to others. So this module is called Transforming Problems, and you know, we can learn a lot about Buddhism. You know, we can make it an academic exercise if we wish. We can learn about karma and the various, you know, the four of this and the ten of that, and you know, all the different types of results and the whys and the et cetera, right? But, you know, if it doesn't pierce our hearts, then it's of some consequence, but of not much consequence. And that's what they say. That's what the lamas say. That's what our teachers say. So this module is about how to use the teachings to actually help us deal with problems, right? It doesn't say that our problems will go away, because that's not possible, at least until we beyond the reach of karma, right? But while we are ordinary beings, while we haven't attained ultimate wisdom, right? We are we are within the realm of karma and cyclic existence, right? So by definition, then we will have problems. So the question is, we can either let the problems, we can succumb to the problems, or we can transcend them, right? And so this module is about what do the teachings say about how to make the best of it, right? And have some level of equanimity and still be of benefit to ourselves and to others, right? So it's about thought transformation. You know, there's this great body of work or body of teachings called Lojong teachings, mind training teachings, right? What mind training basically means, how to transform the way we think, right? How transform the way we react or act in general, right? In the face of difficulty, right? It's easy to act properly when everything's going well, but the rubber really hits the road when we're faced with difficulty. So transforming problems basically really means transforming our minds, right? How we how we actually perceive. Right, perceive the world, perceive others. We have to understand. Those of you who have gone through the other classes, right, like karma, samsara. I think samsara is a separate class, right? Yeah, samsara, nirvana. So it's up through karma, samsara, nirvana. And through some of the other modules, right? The cause of our problems, right, is not, well, first of all, our problems, the Buddha said, don't lie outside, right? I mean, they don't lie externally. It's really the perception that we have. How we perceive people and phenomena, right? People and situations and things, right? So that's the cause of our problems. And an easy way to, kind of understand that is that, if you have four people in a room and there's a particular, something happens, you take the people outside and you ask them the same question to the four different people, they probably will have four different interpretations of what happened. Right, so that kind of tells you that it's not really what happened that was, it's not the fact really, the facts are really how people perceive them, right? So if we can change the way we perceive things, we can change the way we let them affect us, right? So that's the idea. And so if we can transform problems, which means that we are able to deal with them well, right? It creates the causes for happiness, future happiness, right? It allows us to develop the bodhicitta, the mind of great compassion, a mind of the mind that wants to benefit others, be of service, right? Be of help, be helpful. And that's really, those of you who have been studying the Lam Rim and the other modules, that is the doorway to Nirvana, doorway to the Mahayana practice, right? Is until we, they say that until we can engender in our minds the thought, right? That may I be of help, may I be of benefit, right? Even in the face of difficulty, may I be of benefit. When we're able to do that, we are truly entering, we're just kind of making the first baby step Right? And there's all these other steps after that. But that's like, that's the basic requirement, right? So if we're able to transform problems, we kind of are making the baby step to entering the Mahayana path. Without which one, you know, you have to be on the Mahayana path to attain enlightenment, right? So, and the good news is that we all are capable of attaining enlightenment, right? So that's the good thing. In fact, not only are we capable, we will. I mean, that's what they say, right? We will all be enlightened at some point in the future. Some may be earlier than others, but nevertheless, we all will, right? So we can take the teachings to heart and enter the Mahayana path now and take the short way, or we can make lots of detours. Sooner or later, we'll have to still go the same way and, you know, go the long way through the path, right? But we'll just, yeah. You know. But at the end, we'll all make it, right? So that's the... So before I continue, I was going to say that... So what we'll do is... in this. So there is a great practice in this course, which we do, right? Which is what is the technical name? Taking Tonglen, right? The giving and take, taking and giving. So that's a practice that's a standard practice that the teachers, you know, Lama Zopa Rinpoche and all of our teachers suggest that all of us do on a daily basis to help us, right? So we will be doing that practice, and I'm going to actually use Lama Zopa's, his own words. I have the meditation. So I'm going to use his own words to do the meditation, right? So we'll probably spend, so we have, I think, four, maybe five, but I think there are four classes in this module. So we'll probably spend the last half hour just doing that practice, right? So we'll talk for the first hour, and then we'll just do it. So that way, you can kind of every week, we'll go over it, right? So it kind of helps us internalize it. I'm hoping that you'll also do something similar when you're at home. I don't know if I can find a way to send this to you, the text itself. I don't have an electronic copy at the moment, but I can create one. So to understand what the nature of our problems, we kind of have to understand, or we have to remind ourselves how we end up with problems, right? So if we think about it, you know, if you go, you know, what the Buddha said was that, you know, we're all in samsara, right? We have this this cycle of birth, old age, sickness, death, and all the other stuff that happens in between, right? So, by the way, I saw this great, you know, I saw this great movie poster about a couple of months ago. There was some movie, I don't know what movie it was. It was Tom Cruise in there. It had a big poster. And he had this submachine gun on him, and there was some beautiful woman next to him, I can't remember. But I remember I don't remember the name of the movie, but it said in big letters, you know, the slogan. It said, live, die, repeat. You know? And I'm thinking, you know, I wonder if it was a Buddhist who came up with that slogan. But anyway, live, die, repeat. So yeah, so, you know, that's what the Buddha said, right? We're in samsara, we have birth, old age, sickness, death, and all the other stuff that happens in between, right? Which he didn't really mention in there, but there's a lot of other stuff that happens in between, all the divorces and the separations and the anxieties and the stresses and work and so forth, you know, all this other stuff that happens, right? So the root of all that, you know, we think that it happens kind of, you know, when something, difficulty happens, right? We tend to blame it on somebody else, right? But when we think about it, it really, what the Buddha said was that it's not really external. It's happened as a result. It's just a natural law, right? It's a natural law of karma, right? Some past action that we took, negative action. There are lots of good things that happen, by the way. We're, you know, with the fact that we're born in this country and the fact that we live here, the fact that we have good educations, all those, you know, there are many, many positive things that have happened as well, which are also the result of positive things we've done in the past, right? So it's not only just negative things that we're talking about here. But this is all a result of actions that we have taken in the past, right? And so, you know, it's like a natural law. You know, if something goes up, it'll come down, gravity being a natural law. In this case, karma is a natural law, he said, which is that regardless of whether you're Buddhist or not, it will happen, right? So you take an action. If you have positive intention and positive action, then it will, you know, result in a good, you know, good result, right? Or if it's a negative, you know, something negative that you did, then it's a negative action, right? So the karma, our cycle of birth, et cetera, is really a result of our previous actions. That's all. Right? And then the question is, why does it happen? I mean, what is the root of committing those actions in the first place? Right? And, you know, those he's talked about were the three poisons, right? Attachment, aversion, and ignorance, right? And so attachment and aversion are both two sides of the same coin, basically, right? Attachment is grasping at something because we exaggerate its good qualities, right? We want more of it, whether it's a person or a thing or whatever, right? Or, you know, aversion is disliking something by exaggerating its bad qualities. That's really all there. So it's two sides of the same coin, right? So it's really attachment and aversion that, and then the ignorance we'll talk about in a minute, but attachment and aversion are kind of the basic things that drive us, right? If you think about what we do in our lives, it's all at the root of it, at the end of it. If you really examine why we work, why we have relationships, why we do anything that we do, right? It's attachment or aversion. And you can do that exercise yourself, you know, during the week. But that's what it comes down to. So if we recognize that, you know, okay. So there's attachment aversion, that's the root of it, right? And then this manifestation is, if you remember, is the eight worldly concerns, right? So there's those four things and their opposites, right? So material gain and loss, right? That's one. Comfort, right? And hardship, that's the second one, right? We always crave comfort. We detest hardship, right? So we're always trying to do things that will bring us more comfort, we think, right? Or gain, you know, material wealth and we don't want poverty. So those are the first two. Then there's praise and blame, right? We want praise and we don't want blame. So that drives, you know. And the last is, we want fame, which is good reputation here, really. Right? So we want fame and we don't want the opposite. I don't know what it is. Ignominy? I don't know what it is. Something like that, right? But, you know, so those are the four, you know, the four things and their opposites, right? You know, wealth, comfort, praise, and reputation, right? So everything that we do is driven by those four things. Right, or the eight worldly, it's called eight worldly concerns if you add the opposites to them, right? So the eight worldly concerns are the basis, you know, why we eat, why we crave good food, why we want more of the chocolate, why we want the next girlfriend or the next husband, whatever it is, why we want, you know, or why we don't like our current girlfriend or husband, you know, all those reasons, all those things, every bit of it is because of the eight worldly concerns. And underneath the eight worldly concerns are attachment and aversion, right? Because we exaggerate, you know, the attachment, you know, when we want something, we want more of the chocolate or the next girlfriend, it's because we, you know, we exaggerate the chocolates or the girlfriend's good qualities, so we want, you know, we want to be next to her all the time, Or after 6 months, I'm kind of tired of her, so I'm kind of, you know, I have aversion towards her, right? And so that's what drives us. It's kind of funny when you think about it, because, you know, it's, I think one of my teachers said this, Tibetan teacher said this. He said that, you know, when you think about it, we're not that different from animals. You know, it's kind of, when you think about it, with the eight worldly concerns, if you boil it down to the eight worldly concerns, it's really not that different. You know, we think we're really special, but we're not all that special, I guess. But anyway, so you know, you have the eight worldly concerns, and the, underneath it is the our primal attachment and aversion. And then, you know, underneath that, of course, is ignorance, right? Which the Buddha taught, you know, the root of all the issues that we have is ignorance, which is that it's not just ignorance in general. In English, means not knowing something, right? Being unaware of something. But here, it's not just not being unaware. It's not. It's actually. It's believing something to be opposite. It's seeing. It's perceiving something opposite of what it really is. Right. Perceiving reality in this case. Right. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But perceiving reality in the opposite way of what it really is. But not just that. Believing it. That's the difference. Right. We are aware of, see reality or the way things actually exist, opposite of how they are, and then we really believe it, right? So that's the ignorance that the Buddha was talking about. So underneath it all is this ignorant view of how things really are. And so the thought transformation or the thought transforming problems, thought transformation, that whole set of teachings is really about counteracting the eight worldly concerns. That's what it really is about, right? When the mind training texts are all about how to counter the eight worldly concerns so that we can cut the cycle, right? As we continue to do, you know, if we're continuously driven by the eight worldly concerns, we will continuously for endless time, I guess, continue to just be in that same cycle of samsara, right, of cyclic existence. But since we have this precious human rebirth and we are able to discriminate and think and all those things, we can cut the cycle. And so once we cut the cycle, then we are once and for all free, right? So that's the goal. But in between, what's most important is that while, you know, it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, until we become free, we can't do anything, right? I mean, there's a lot of work that we can do in between. And, you know, we'll talk about how, you know, to transform problems, you know, we have to always be cherishing others, right? That's the key, right? So, you know, in Buddhism, as you may have found out, or you will find out, is that the more we, even during our greatest difficulties, if we are able to just step out of it a little bit, step out of our own, I don't know, skin, our own, you know, when we are under great stress, let's say, you know, it feels like we're in a kind of like a cave, you know, almost, you know, dark, and it's, you know, whatever vision, you know, whatever it, however it feels to you, right? And so if we're able to just step out of it and just see that it's not just us, right? There are many, many people around us who are going through the same kinds of problems. We're not the only ones, right? There's 6 billion of us, right? At least. I mean, just as human beings. So, you know, if we are able to just transcend and just be, just get us out of our own, this, you know, our own selves for a little bit, and just be able to just, you know, have a broader picture, and not only broader picture, a more of an altruistic motivation, or just a, you know, a compassion for ourselves as for others who might be going through it, it brings lightness to our difficulties. You know, it doesn't feel so. We don't feel so powerless. And it makes it easier to cope with. And so all of those things, you know, so you know, and in fact, I was actually reading this. There was an article in a News and Observer, like 4 months ago. They were doing a study at Duke, and somewhere, I can't remember which other university it was, and did a study about, you know, it was about happiness, what makes people happy. And they found that, you know, they surveyed all these, or they did this test with all these people, and I think that the things that they said, you know, they asked people about, you know, what makes you, you know, they rated people, or they rated the activities they engaged in based on, you know, how long the happiness continues, you know. And so there's some chemical, I don't know, so that chemical makes us, you know, feel good and so forth and so on. So they kind of examine how long it continues and so forth and so on, right? So I think the things they had was like going to get a massage. I think there was some exercise involved, and there were a few other things. And then one other thing was, you know, going and volunteering at a soup kitchen or something that brings, you know, that was really for others, you know, you really didn't get that much benefit out of it, but, you know, you actually had to do work. But it actually had some value to others, right? And it was interesting. They found that, you know, like getting a massage or something, that those chemicals last in your brain for maybe a day. And there, you kind of back down to where you were, right? But they found that if you actually went and worked in a soup kitchen or some equivalent activity, right, that it lasts a lot longer. It was like a couple of weeks, you know? So the effect of that, so that's kind of like, you know, it's kind of, I guess, you know, I don't know how reliable these things are, but anyway, but that's what, you know, that's what the Buddhism talks about, and not just Buddhism, to be honest. I mean, Christianity talks about it too, and other religions talk about it as well, about service to others, right? But they may not say it in the same way, right? But Buddhism says it very specifically, that to bring happiness to yourself, the best way you can do this is to cherish others, right? To be of service to others. Which is counterintuitive, and we'll talk about that. You know how, you know, so the cause of suffering is really there's two things, which is self-cherishing and self-grasping, right? Self-grasping and self-cherishing, they say. So self-grasping is this, you know, that's the ignorance that we were talking about, right? Which is that we have this view of ourselves as number one, right? We exaggerate. We have a wrong view of who we are, right? And we have this view of who we are, right? You know, each of us, if you ask the question, you know, what are the adjectives that you use to describe yourself, you know? I think very rarely will we come up with an adjective that's actually somewhat negative, you know? You know, if you think about it, I mean, if you were really objective, not objective, if somebody asked you that question, I doubt if you'd say, I'm a pain to be around, or, you know, I'm cranky most of the time, I have very little patience. All those things, you know, there's very, you know, you would probably say I'm a good husband, or I'm a good father, or I'm a good worker, or I'm, you know, I'm well educated, or I'm thoughtful, or whatever all those adjectives are, right? So we have this view of who we are. And, you know, other people have, you know, probably have a much more nuanced view of who you are. You know, to put it mildly, maybe. So it's like that. We have a view of who we are. It's totally fabricated. It's a construction, right? It's a construction of our minds. And it's not just who we are. When I see you, I have a view of who you are, which is a total fabrication on my side too, right? I think it's reality, right? I mean, you must be the who you are because I see you that way, right? How else could it be? But it's a complete construction, right? So because of that, we exaggerate the good qualities that each of us have. I have, right? I exaggerate the good qualities that I have. Which means that, you know, I build myself up. And there's nothing wrong with having, you know, some amount of self-appreciation, you know, to care for one. You know, it doesn't mean that we have to think that, oh, actually, we'll get to that in a minute. So I have this, I exaggerate my good qualities and I build it up. And then, of course, what happens is that my way must be the right way, right? Because I'm the best, right? Or at least I'm better than you, right? So that's the delusion, right, that the Buddha talked about. You know, we have this reality, we have this sense of what the reality is, but it isn't like that at all. And actually, there's a much, much more deeper and subtle, I'm not even going there, right? That's just the kind of the shallow, the tip of the iceberg version, right? So, you know, we have this view of reality, but it's totally wrong. And that's the delusion that we have. And that's the root of, that's the ignorance that he spoke about. And so because of that ignorance, we have this inflated sense of self. We grasp at that self, which means that it has to be right. It has to be fed all the time. You know, it has to have the best of everything. You know, it's all those things. You get the picture, right? So the self appears to us in a more gross way than it really exists. You know, it's like we build it up and then we hold that view to be true. Right? That's the ignorance that the Buddha talked about. You know, it's not just being unaware of how the self truly exists. It's having this opposite view and then really truly believing that's the only way it really is, right? So that's the ignorance. And the self-grasping, that's the self-grasping, right? And ignorance actually is broader than just self-grasping, the Buddha talked about, you know, just for clarification here, right? Ignorance is more than that. I mean, self-grasping is a part of ignorance. But we grasp at everything, that is all phenomena, right, like that. And that's the ignorance part of it. So based on that self-grasping, we have self-cherishing, right? Because we believe in this, you know, the idea of who, this thing that we built myself up. I've built myself up, right? So I then, you know, based on that wrong view, you know, I my needs have to be, you know, more, have to be more, are of more greater importance than anybody else's needs, right? And so that's the self-cherishing that happens, right? The self-grasping kind of fuels the self-cherishing. And then the self-cherishing, of course, fuels everything else, right? My girlfriend isn't treating me well. How dare she? Because I'm the best. I deserve better. And so I'm going to look for the next one, right? I mean, it's really, you know, it's relatively simple when it comes down to it. I mean, that's kind of how it works for us. Or whatever, pick whatever your push button is, right? You know, it's funny, this happened to me last week. It was actually very interesting. I found it very interesting. Which was that, I'll make the story really short, which is that I got cable for the first time in many, many years, right? Because I love baseball. It's baseball season. I've been without Baseball Tonight for 5 years now, and I finally gave up. I had to watch Baseball Tonight. It's the only thing I miss from having cable. Only thing I ever watch, really, Baseball Tonight, that one-hour show. Anyways, I finally gave in. I said, okay, for $60 a month, I'll pay for Baseball Tonight, right? And so anyway, so I called the cable company, you know, I don't know, April 1st, whatever it was. And they said, oh, yeah, sure, we'll be there on April 7th, blah, blah, blah. April 7th comes, it's like, they get bid 9 o'clock in the morning, nobody comes. So I call them up, and I'm making the story really short here. I call them up, and they have no record that I ever called, right? They don't even know that I'm supposed to show up. Yeah, but I mean, you can replace it with any cable company, I'm sure. Anyway, so I'm like, oh my God, I have to go through all this again, go through the packages, all the stuff, and give them my address, and I thought, all this stuff, right? And you know, it's interesting, you know, and during that time, I was quite annoyed, right? And I was thinking, you know, I mean, I was really upset. Actually, I was not just annoyed, I was upset. And I'm thinking, why am I so upset? Well, you know, it's kind of funny, you know, I'm seeing myself be upset, but I can't stop myself from being upset, you know. But I'm asking this, you know, I'm thinking, you know, because when stuff like this happens, I kind of go back, you know, I think, okay, what did my teacher say? How do I deal with this? You know, and I'm watching my upsetness, but I can't do anything about it. So I'm kind of like looking at it curiously. Like, why am I getting really upset, you know? It's kind of interesting if you think about it, you know. Because, you know, it's, all right, it's 2025, you know, it's not like I had to be at work at a particular time, so I had the flexibility. So, you know, it's not like it's affecting my day that much. Yeah, it's an extra 20 minutes that I have to be on the phone, but it's not that big of a deal. You know, when it comes down to it, when life's great inconveniences, that's got to be, like, not, like, high on the list, you know, extra 20 minutes on the phone. And so, you know, but it's really bothered me, you know, and you know, and I was examining it, you know, and during the day I was at work, and I'm still thinking about it. Kind of like, it's interesting. Why am I upset about this? Because I was still upset 5 or 6 hours later. And you know, and you realize that the reason I was upset is because I expected to be treated better. Right? I mean, that was really it. I deserve better. Right? I mean, that's really all it came down to. How dare the guy not put, you know. And I didn't think about it. Maybe the guy was having a bad day, you know. Maybe he found out this kid had a problem or something. And maybe his kid's in the hospital. He forgot. You know, he took all my information. He must have forgotten to put the last button, you know, where you have to push, you know, to say, send it off. You know, they even gave me a work order number and everything, but the number didn't exist. So he must have forgotten to push that last button, right? But I couldn't think of that, right? I'm too busy thinking about my own problems, right? How could I have been treated this way, right? And it's interesting. That's kind of, that was like, the, you know, for me, that was like, you know, so that's how and that's pretty much how all of our interactions with the world is like. Because we expect to be treated better, right? Because my needs are greater than others. And, you know, and you could argue that, okay, you know, if it were a life and death situation, you could argue, well, you know, I think that he probably should have done a better, you know, whatever it is, right? I mean, there's a lot. But, I mean, in this particular situation, it really didn't deserve the energy that I expended on it. It really didn't. You know, I spent more energy, you know, thinking about this thing, right, than it probably even deserved. So, yeah. I don't know if you have been to Geshe Lo's Sunday teachings, he's used this example, it's a classic example. You know, those who are liberated, those who are enlightened, Arya beings, right? Actually, Arya beings aren't necessarily enlightened. They're just beings who see, who actually don't have this ignorance anymore. They see the way things really exist, right? They see that they're grasping at themselves or they're not. You know, those, you know, though they're not, you know, they don't have the sense, inflated sense of self. They don't have they don't perceive others the way we see them as concrete and, you know, judged and so forth and so on, right? So they have this completely different view of the world. And so the analogy, the classic analogy they use is, you know, the magician. You know, Geshe Lo has used this example, I think, in the last couple of weeks, but it's a classic example that it's all actually the Buddha used this, I think, which is that, you know, a magician, you know, let's say that he, you know, he has a, you know, he makes a, he creates this illusion, and he makes this image of an elephant. An elephant or a horse are the two things used. An elephant out of a piece of rock, piece of stone that's in front of you, right? And he makes this illusion, right? And there's an audience. And the audience sees the elephant, and they're like, wow! They believe that the elephant really is there, right? They don't see the rock. They just see the elephant. And it's like, wow! They're totally fooled by the elephant, right? So that's us. The magician is, he sees the elephant, right? But he also sees the rock. So the Aryan, so once one has removed that ignorance, that this prism that we use, have, through which we see everything and create the self and the create, you know, all this image that we conceive, all the things that we construct, right? They see that, you know, they see both things at the same time. It's like an illusion to them, right? And we can only aspire to that one day. But once, if we're able to do that, and they're beings, it's not like, you know, they're like, oh, they were 500 years ago or whatever. Those beings exist even today. By the way, speaking of which, a plug here. On May 3rd, here, Lama Zopa Rinpoche, a living bodhisattva, if, you know, I mean, a truly an amazingly great being. You know, one of my teachers and some of my teachers' teachers, he is, some of my teachers' teachers, you know. He's an incredible, you know, being. And if you're able to come on May 3rd, I would strongly encourage you to come, because to be in the presence of such a high being is a great blessing. Even if you never come to a Discovering Buddhism class again, even though you may never come to Kadampa Center again, it's okay, right? But what happens is, they say, is that if we are in the presence of such beings, we make a connection, right? Maybe that connection won't bear fruit in this lifetime, but in some future life, somewhere, that connection will come, you know, we will come back to the spiritual practice, whatever spiritual practice it is, right? So we create the seeds for future growth, right? So it's not just, you know, so we have to think like that, right? So if you're able, so if you're able to make it on May 3rd, please come. And and if you're not able to stay for the whole thing, that's fine too. Leave in the middle if you need to. He doesn't care. So he's a person like the magician, right? He does not see the elephant anymore, right? So there are many beings like that. Actually, even now, I mean, you know, among us, actually, and I know, you know, I mean, you've seen some of them, you may not know them, you know, and I've seen some of them, you know, and so it's not that it's not doable. Okay, anyway, so why should we cherish others? Right, so there's a great section, you know, you can read this, there's a Lam, in the Lam Rim, you know, in the great stages, in the stages of the path to enlightenment, there are many books about it. There's a section on why we should, benefits of cherishing others, right? And I'm not going through the whole section. But basically, you know, the short answer is that cherishing others is the root of all our happiness. So, if we are able to limit our self-grasping, and we're all capable of doing that, if we're able to limit our self-grasping and we think about others, even in the presence of difficulties, think about their benefit, then we create the seeds of positive intention, right? And karma is basically nothing other than just intention, right? An action. An action is positive or negative based on what the intention is. So, because, for example, you know, if a person gives food to a, you know, to someone else, right, to a beggar or anybody, right, food to somebody else, that action by itself is not positive. Because if I give food to that person with the attitude that, you know, I'm so, you know, I have so much more than this guy, right? You know, it's out of pride, right? It's out of self, you know, increasing the myself, you know, my view of myself, right? That's a negative intention, actually. So that action is not positive, it's negative. However, if I give food to somebody out of just pure generosity, then that's a very positive action, right? So that right there, you can see that the action by itself is not positive or negative. It's the intention that is positive or negative, makes it positive or negative. So all of our, you know, future happiness comes from cherishing others, because when you cherish others, you're creating all this positive, you know, it's by definition a positive intention. You can't cherish others out of negative intention. I'm pretty sure. Yeah. So it creates the causes of many, of all our future, all the positive things that we want for ourselves, right? So all the positive things that we have today is not out of blind luck, right? It's because we have created the causes for all this to have, you know, the fact that we have roof over our heads, that we have enough to eat, that we live in a country that's free, you know, that we have a human life, that we have, you know, that we have all our mental faculties. All those things that they talk about, right? That's not by accident. It's because we have done many, many positive things in the past. And so if we continue to do those kinds of things, we create, and we've also cherished others in the past too, right? So if we're able to do that, continue that practice, then we create further positive, create the causes for positive results in the future, which is necessary for us to continue on our spiritual path, right? You know, it's said in the scriptures that this human life that we have is extremely rare, and they explain all the reasons why it's so rare and so precious, etc. But one of the reasons is that, you know, it's the only way that we can attain enlightenment. It's the only type of life that we can have. You know, the gods don't have, you know, even the gods, the human life is even higher in potential, right, than the gods. And then, of course, the animals and so, and all the other, you know, the realms, other realms, et cetera, right? So, so to create the causes to have a human rebirth, actually, one has to, you know, that's one of the preconditions, is to be able to be of benefit to others. What creates a condition for a human life is actually, they just say, virtuous action. You know, virtuous actions are the, you know, generosity, et cetera, all those things create the causes for human life. Or refraining from non-virtue, that's what it is. Refraining from non-virtue creates the causes for human life. But, you know, we have to also, but if we are able to cherish others, then it's like they say that cherishing others is like a wish-fulfilling jewel, right? Which is like, you know, they have this mythical jewel that, you know, you make any wish. It's like the genie in a bottle. So you make any wish, except the genie only gives you 3 wishes. But the wish-fulfilling jewel can give you any wish at all times. But anyway, so the wish-fulfilling jewel, it basically grants you any wish that you might have, right? So cherishing others is like that wish-fulfilling jewel, except that it's just not as obvious, you know, it's just not as short. You don't see the benefits in the short term. But, you know, but even like the Duke study, right, looks like there are some short-term benefits. It's just not very visible. And, you know, it's interesting, and it's not just, you know, Geshe-la uses Mother Teresa as a great example, right? Actually, you know, if you go to Geshe-la's house, you'll see that he has magnets, of Mother Teresa magnets on his fridge. You know, he reveres Mother Teresa, so he has all these magnets on his fridge and Mother Teresa's image. But anyway, so, So yeah, so, you know, Mother Teresa, for example, must have been a great bodhisattva. When you read her story, you know, Geshe-la inspired me, so I got this book of her life and I was reading about her. You know, it's really truly, and I come from Calcutta. You know, I actually went to school in Calcutta. I went to the Jesuit. It was staffed by Belgian and French priests. You know, Father Boucher was our principal. But anyway, And it was affiliated with Mother Teresa's, you know, the Catholic, you know, the Archbishop's, the Calcutta Archbishop's house is right next to my school, you know. So they were all, you know, and I never really learned much about Mother Teresa. I mean, I knew about Mother Teresa, but I never really thought much about her. It's only after Geshe-la started talking about Mother Teresa that I really went and said, oh, you know, I should go, you know. So it's really inspiring, you know. And so she must have been an incredible bodhisattva, if not a Buddha, I don't know. You know, one doesn't know, right? But she definitely was a great bodhisattva. And so it kind of just goes to show that these things aren't just made up. When you read the text and you read the Lamrim or whatever, it looks like, oh, they use examples of a goat and, you know, all this. You know, they use examples that they seem like they're not really relevant in our modern lives of iPhones and so forth and so on, right? Those beings are still, here among us, like Lama Zopa Rinpoche. If you come, you'll see, you know. And there are many teachers like them, and many people who are, one doesn't know who they are, you know, they're serving. And, you know, they don't advertise themselves. But they're there, right? So it's possible. We can be like them as well. So, gosh, I'm late already. But anyway, in this class, some of you may be familiar with this. It's called the 8 Verses of Mahayana Thought Mind Training. Some of you may be aware of it. And so, what I thought we'd do is, it's only 8 verses. So basically, what we do is that in each class we will kind of go through the verses, you know, because that's a kind of a great way of talking about this. And so I'll just read you all the 8. And this is Lama Zopa's rendition of the 8 verses from the Tibetan. And I'll just read them. All 8 of them right now, and then we'll go through, verse at a time. So the first verse is, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit of all his title is, the overflowing nectar of Mahayana thought training, annihilating the demon of the self-cherishing mind. So, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I shall hold them most dear at all times. But in the company of others, I shall always consider myself the lowest of all, and from the depths of my heart, hold others dear and supreme. Vigilant, the moment a delusion appears in my mind, endangering myself and others, I shall confront and avert it without delay. Whenever I see beings who are wicked in nature and overwhelmed by violent negative actions and suffering, I shall hold such rare ones dear, as if I had found a precious treasure. When, out of envy, others mistreat me with abuse, insults, or the like, I shall accept defeat and offer victory to others. When someone whom I have benefited and in whom I have great hopes gives me terrible harm, I shall regard that person as my holy guru. In short, both directly and indirectly, do I offer every happiness and benefit to all my mothers. I shall secretly take upon myself all their harmful actions and suffering. Undefiled by the stains of the superstitions of the 8 worldly concerns, may I, by perceiving all phenomena as illusory, be released from the bondage of attachment. So those are the 8 verses of Mahayana thought training, which are the basis of, it's basically an extremely shortened version of all the mind training texts that, there are many, many volumes written on these 8 verses, So the first verse. So it says, determined to obtain the greatest possible benefit from all sentient beings who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel, I shall hold them most dear at all times. And so, it's important to, so it says, I shall hold them most dear. It says, who are more precious than a wish-fulfilling jewel. So it's interesting to consider why they're most dear, or why are they like the wish-fulfilling jewel, right? So we should think of they're most dear because they're not that different from us. We hold ourselves very, very dearly, right? But as His Holiness Dalai Lama says, when he meets other people, he says, he's just like me. I want happiness. He wants happiness. That's really what it comes down to, right? Every moment in our lives, we basically, all our actions are performed basically because we think it's going to bring us happiness. That's really why. That's really it, right? Every moment, every thought that we have, every action that we action that we engage in, right, is because it's going to bring us happiness. It may be the most deluded thing that we might do, but it's still, the guy who kills somebody at the liquor store, he thinks it's going to bring him happiness. Because, maybe he gets $50-$100 out of the cash register, right? It's kind of twisted, but that's what it is. And so we may not commit murder, but we, do other things, right? And so other people are just like that, right? They, all their actions are just so that it will bring them happiness. And so if we remember that, they're just like us. It's not that difficult to see why they should be, their lives are just as precious as ours. They make the same mistakes as we do. And we make many, many mistakes, right? The other reason to the texts say is they have the Buddha nature, right? The potential to be enlightened, right? All the qualities that are needed to become a Buddha, they have it just like we do. So they deserve to be treated just as we would want to be someone else to treat us, right? Which is that they would take care of us, they would cherish us, so forth and so on. And then the other one they use is that which is more classical reasoning, which is that if you consider that we've had endless lives, right, they say that we've had beginningless lives since beginningless time. They say we have been gone through the cycle of birth, death and rebirth. For beginningless time, right? So if that's the case, they say that the scriptures say that every being that we come into contact with at some point or other in the past has been our mothers, for example, or our fathers, or our relatives, whoever you hold dear, right? Our dog and our cat is the same way, right? So if we truly believe that, if you do the logic and it makes sense to you, then we have to hold them. Just like we hold our mother in this life dear, we should hold other beings around us just like that, right? It's a little more difficult to one has to kind of really meditate on it, And that's part of the generating bodhicitta, right? The generating the mind of great compassion is one has to kind of go through this process and see why others should be held dearly. Dearly, is that a... Right? Yeah, dearly. Others should be held dearly. And if one is able to do that, then you get the sense that, it's really worthwhile, to be kind and loving and generous and not always be so wrapped up in ourselves. So they want happiness just like us. They've been our mother at some point. That's why Lama Zopa, when you see, by the way, I don't know, some of you, this may be the first time you come across this, when they say, like he says, and the benefit to all my mothers, that's what he means. My mother, sentient beings, because all sentient beings have been my mother at some point in my previous lives, right? So that's what it means. And then he says, It's like a wish fulfilling, you know, the greatest possible benefit. Yeah. So, and then the other interesting thing is that, you know, without other sentient beings, without these other beings who annoy us and do, you know, try our patience and make us jealous or angry or envious, and so all these emotions that we have, without them, we depend on them, because without them, we can't reach Buddhahood. Because if we were on a desert island all by ourselves, right, who would you practice with, right? I mean, you know, other beings are basically a source of, when you have difficulty, that is the impetus for practice, right? I mean, there's a reason that they say that the lives of the gods is inferior to the lives of humans, right? Because the gods have such an amazing existence, right? They live for many, many years. I don't exactly remember now. You know, 1,000 years? I can't remember their lifetime. But they live for many, many years, and their lives are just wondrous. You know, they're just, everything is taken care of. Food is beautiful. The environment's beautiful. All the women are beautiful. Everybody's beautiful, you know? And so nobody ages, you know. They stay beautiful forever. I mean, all that stuff. You know, it's just wonderful, right? Well, the problem is that they had this great karma. They created all this positive merit to be born as a god, but they wasted their whole life because there was no incentive to practice. So they used up all this positive merit to have this wonderful life. And so they say that the last moment, of just before they're about to die, they see what their next life is going to be like. And it's a great shock and disappointment. That's the one time in their lives that they actually feel, you know, suffering. But in any case, that's why being a god is not considered, it's considered inferior to being born a human. Because as a human, we have all the perfect conditions, right, to practice. And so, because we have to be around other people or animals, even if we don't have people, you know, like Geshe-la's cat used to really bug him. You know, he has stories. You know, that was his way of practicing, right? When he didn't have, you know, Geshe Sangpo at the time, right? So now Geshe Sangpo has replaced his cat, he says. But before that it was his cat. And so like that, you know, we depend on other people for many, many reasons, right? I mean, we depend on them for our food. We depend on the farmer, you know, to produce the food and so forth and so on. We depend on the insects or the bees to pollinate the flowers so we can get our, you know, all the, we depend on so many, it's such an interdependent web, right? So even if you set that aside, right, we depend on human beings and our pets and animals, et cetera, because without them, we would not be able to attain Buddhahood. Because we would not be able to, we wouldn't practice. There wouldn't be a reason for you to be even here, I expect. I expect the reason you're here, you know, is because you have difficulties in your lives and you think, okay, well, maybe I'm curious and maybe there's a way for me to, you know, there must be a way, right, to have a better way of dealing with this, right? And I don't mean there's an immediate difficulty. There might be just a, you know, at least that's what it was for me that brought me to Buddhism, right? And that's why you're curious. That's why you're thinking. That's why you're, you know, all those things, right? So, right there, right? And I bet that all these difficulties have to do because of some other person. We don't like it necessarily, but that's how it is. You know, I mean, we don't like the fact that we had to deal with this other person, but, you know, it is what it is, you know. So without sentient beings, so that's why we have to hold them, we have to cherish them, is because they're the only way we're going to attain Buddhahood. And then, of course, you know, they say that we need them in the beginning, we need them in the middle, and we need them at the end, right? We need them in the beginning because it forces us to practice. We need them in the middle because, you know, the two great accumulations, right? Accumulation of merit and the accumulation of wisdom. And the only way to accumulate merit is through our virtuous actions and especially through cherishing others and being of benefit to others, right? So that's the way of accumulating merit. And then finally, at the end, when we have attained Buddhahood, that's our only job, actually, is to help others, right? So we need sentient beings to hold them dearly always, right? In the beginning, in the middle, and in the end. So maybe what we'll do is, I might run a little bit late, but I apologize, but maybe what we'll do is, we'll do this meditation. Let's see where we get to, you know. So this meditation is called taking and giving, and so it's maybe I'll have to do a shortened version. We'll see. But it's called Tonglen practices, taking and giving. It means to when we're facing difficulty. And easy, you know, and we don't know what else one can do, right? A lot of times we face difficulty, we don't know what to do. And sometimes there's nothing one can do. But it's if we are able to engender this feeling of being of benefit, even that, just that intention, actually helps us lighten our load. Just that. You know, we don't have to do anything, just being able to just think outside of ourselves, just get out of the self-cherishing mind, helps us lighten our load. And it's interesting. If you do it, I promise you that you will find that this is happening. If you remember to do it, that's the first great obstacle, right? Is we don't remember to do it. But if you are able to get to a point where you remember to do it, I guarantee you that it will lighten your load. And I know this from personal experience, and I know that others, you know, like, for example, someone I know it was the middle of the night, and he was in the bathroom, and he was going through, you know, like, he was having such bad stomach cramps that he thought that he was going, truly was going, it was so bad, he was about to faint, and he really thought that he might die. You know, he didn't know why the stomach cramps were happening. And he really, truly thought that he was going to die. And at that moment, you know, he thought, I must not be the only one in this world who's going through this pain right now. You know? So can you, and he was thinking, you know, how terrible it must be that all these people must be suffering the same way that I am. You know, there's six, you know, it's true, you know, if I'm going through this much suffering and it hurts so much, what it must be like for them, you know? And she was able to think like that. And it truly helped him. You know, he calmed his mind. He did faint, by the way, but he lived to tell the tale. But in that moment, it was no longer about his pain. I mean, the pain was still there, right? It's not like the pain went away. The pain was still there, but it helped him just not be so overcome, you know, by that pain. And so like that, you know, if we're able to... So taking and giving is that kind of practice where we... you know, and sometimes we're not able to, you know, like, sometimes what I'll do is, for example, and my kids know this practice now too, which is that, you know, you stopped at a stoplight and you see this guy on the side, right? You know, he's homeless or, you know, whatever. And, you know, you wonder, what should you do? Right? You're not sure if first of all, a lot of times I don't have any cash at all. So even if I were able to give, I mean, if I got myself to give, I didn't have anything to give anyway, right? Other time you wonder if your money is going to be used wisely, is it going to go for, you know, buy the next drink or the next hit or whatever it is. Whatever all those things are, right? Whatever goes through our mind and stops us from giving. It's immaterial, right? But if we're not able to give, at least we can do this, you know, this practice where you imagine that all his suffering or her suffering, you know, comes in like black smoke, right? All the pain and the loss and the grieving and physical pain, emotional pain, whatever he's going through, right? Comes in as black smoke. And then there, in our hearts, there's this, they use the word like a bright light or like a burning ember. They use, you know, like our hearts is a burning ember. which is the self-cherishing mind, you know. And so the visualization they use is, you know, the black smoke comes in and it just gets burned, you know, a couple of things they use. You know, one is that the black smoke comes in and totally just burns a self-cherishing mind, you know, like just, you know, and the outcomes, just pure compassion and love in the form of white light that goes to that person, right? So that's a taking, you know, taking in their suffering and their pain and giving them love, compassion, all the positive things that we want, may they have it as well, like that, right? It doesn't mean, by the way, sometimes people ask, does it mean that I'm taking on their suffering and pain, right? It doesn't mean that, right? One cannot take somebody, you know, if you have studied karma, you'll know, right? Karma is definite. Karma cannot, you know, if you, your karma will not ripen on, if you haven't done the action, it will not ripen upon you, right? So all those four points, right? So one of those points is, you cannot take on somebody else's karma, right? So this is basically, it's to, for us to engender that loving heart. That's really all it's for, right? So we imagine that we take in this pain because we feel that pain in different ways. Maybe we haven't been homeless, but we have felt similar loss and in other ways, right? So we take in that pain, but in return, it destroys our self-cherishing mind. That's the bit, right? That's the bit, you know, because it forces us to think about the other person, right? This compassionate thought, and so the white light goes out to them, right? Do you understand me? If you have any concerns about taking on their pain, yeah, okay. So what we'll do is a very short version of it. I'll just skip over some of the things that Rinpoche talks about. So look, why don't we just sit with our back straight and he says, remember the purpose of taking and giving meditation. By generating great compassion, we take suffering and the cause of suffering of numberless sentient beings within ourselves and use them to destroy our self-cherishing thought, the source of all our problems. Set the motivation thinking at this very moment, all our kind mother sentient beings are experiencing great suffering. But they're also running constantly to create the cause for more. There's not even a second in which they can experience a moment's happiness. If a mother's suffering is not alleviated by her own child, who else will do it? First, generate compassion by thinking how living beings constantly experience suffering. Even though they have no wish to do so, because they're ignorant of its causes, or because they know the causes of suffering, but they're too lazy to abandon them. How wonderful it would be if all living beings could be free from all the suffering and the cause of suffering, karma and delusion. I myself will free them from all their suffering and its causes. As you breathe in, imagine you take all the suffering and the cause of suffering of other living beings through your nostrils in the form of black smoke. If you have an illness
or some other problem, focus first on all the numberless beings with that same problem. So if we're having a particular difficulty right now, whether it's physical, emotional, to think that we're not the only ones who are facing this problem. There must be many, many others. So they must be going through the same pain and sorrow and suffering that we are. So as you slowly breathe in the black smoke, take in all the suffering and its causes. Black smoke comes in through your nostrils and absorbs into the self-cherishing thought in your heart, completely destroying it. Your self-cherishing, the creator of all your problems, becomes non-existent. Like aiming a missile right on the target. Aim right at the self-cherishing thought, the target. Take from others all the undesirable environments that they experience. Breathe in through your nostrils in the form of black smoke all the undesirable places the sentient beings experience. For example, the red-hot burning ground of the hot hells, the ice of the cold hells, the inhospitable environments of the hungry ghosts and animals. And all the dirty places in this world that human beings live in. The war zones. The places of genocide. So the black smoke comes in through your nostrils and down into your heart, where it absorbs into your self-cherishing thought and completely destroys it. The self-cherishing thought becomes non-existent. At the same time as your self-cherishing thought becomes completely non-existent, the false I that ignorance holds to be truly existent also becomes completely empty, as it is empty in reality. Next, generate loving kindness by thinking that even though living beings want to be happy, they lack happiness because they're ignorant of its causes or lazy in generating them. And even if they achieve some temporary happiness, like wealth in this lifetime, or happy marriage, so forth and so on, they still lack the ultimate happiness of full enlightenment. Think how wonderful it would be if all living beings had happiness and the cause of happiness. Visualize your body as a wish-granting jewel which can grant all the wishes of living beings. Then give everything you have to every living being, every human being. Give all your good karma of the three times and all the happiness that results from it up to enlightenment. Your possessions, your family and friends, your body visualized as a wish-granting jewel. And also make the offering to all enlightened beings. Human beings receive everything that they want, including all the realizations of the past enlightenment. Those who want a friend, find a friend. Those who want a guru, find a perfect guru. Those who want a job, find a job. Those who want a doctor, find a qualified doctor. Those who want medicine, find medicine. For those with incurable diseases, you become the medicine that cures them. Since the main human problem is difficulty in finding the means of living image that each human being is showered with. Since the main human problem is difficulty in finding the means of living image that each human being is showered with. Never mind, okay, we'll continue. You can also think that the environment becomes a pure land, the pure land of Amitabha or the Buddha of Compassion, for example. You grant all human beings everything they want, including a pure land with perfect enjoyments. All these enjoyments cause them only to generate the path to enlightenment within their mind, and they all become enlightened. In a similar way, give to the worldly gods everything they need, such as protective armor. They also then become enlightened. Then give to all the hell beings. So when we're doing all this offering and giving, we imagine the white light from our heart go out to them, all the beings to whom we're offering all the enjoyments or all the armor and all the pure lands, etc. So then give to all the hell beings and completely transformed environments into a blissful pure land with perfect enjoyments and no suffering at all. Visualize the hells as pure realms, as beautiful as possible. All the iron houses of the hell beings, which are one with fire, become jewel palaces and mandalas. All the hell beings receive everything they want and then become enlightened. Then, for the hungry ghosts, transform the environment into a pure realm, and give them thousands of different foods that all taste like nectar. They have perfect enjoyments and no suffering at all. Their environment is pure and beautiful. The hungry ghosts receive everything they need. But the ultimate point is that they all become enlightened. since animals mainly need protection, we could manifest as Vajrapani. She's the Buddha of power and skillful means. So manifest in Vajrapani or other wrathful deity to protect them from being attacked by other animals. They receive everything they want, and everything they receive becomes the cause for them to actualize the path and become enlightened. Give also to the arhats and bodhisattvas. Give them whatever realizations they need to complete the path to enlightenment. After everyone has become enlightened in this way, rejoice by thinking how wonderful it is that I have enlightened every single being. So we finish by dedicating. I dedicate any merits I have thus created to all this, to the swift enlightenment of all sentient beings. May I become a Buddha to benefit all. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow. And may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. So that's the... Those are Lama Zopa's words. As you, if you come on May 3rd, you will see him in person, and you'll see he has a very wonderful delivery. So you'll hear him, and it's good to come and see a person like that, because then one has a it makes it real, you know. In other words, I was reading this book by Vicky McKenzie. You know, she's also known as Tenzin Palmo. You know, the British nun who, she was one of the earliest, she's like started practicing 1963. And she basically went off to the caves in Nepal for 20 years. And she basically lived in a cave for 20 years. Then she did her practices and so forth and so on. Then she came out because her teacher asked her to, you know, do some work for other people. So she started a nunnery, and she has various projects now she does. But anyway, so she was saying that she used a great analogy, you know, and I was just thinking when I was thinking about Lama Zopa, which is that she was saying that, you know, and one of my teachers said this too. He said that one of the great, you know, one of the things that really hold us back is that we don't have self-confidence. You know, we don't think we can make it. You know, it just seems really far away. You know, it just says in these books and these scriptures and about people who lived hundreds, if not thousands of years ago, and we don't think it can happen to us, right? So we have this great lack of self-confidence. And so she said that the analogy she used is that, you know, you have this mountain road, you know, and, you know, it's covered by fog. And so, you know, in the beginning, all you see is the fog, you know, and then you're driving along this mountain road, and you know that somebody tells you that there's a town at the end of the road, you know, it's a curvy road, you know, and down the valley there's a town, but all you see is the fog, you can't see the town, right? And so you just continue to just go on the road because somebody told you that, you know, that's the road to go on. You know, just keep going on the road. Sooner or later, you'll get to the town. But you just take it on faith, right? And at some point, the fog lifts a little bit, and you kind of see some lights in the distance, maybe. You kind of think, you know, and you're not sure, but kind of, you know, like you see that. And then the fog comes in again, and you lose track sight of it, right? And you go down the mountain some more, and after a while, now you really do see some lights, and you see some, you know, all this other, you know. You get the picture, right? So like that, right? Is that we,
you know, that's the spiritual practice. That's a, you know, the verses of thought, you know, verses of mind training, the thought transformation, all this, all these things that we do is basically to lift that fog, right? The fog as being the ignorance and the delusions and the self-grasping that we talked about, right? And the teacher, you know, our teachers are basically, like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, for example, are the guides who tell us to go down that road, right? We have to have some faith with reasoning, right? That's important, right? After reasoning, we have to have some faith in his words that if we continue down this road, I will sooner or later get to that town. And so what happens is, if one continues, one pursues the path, in whatever little bit we are able to do, you know, because we all have busy lives and so forth and so on, but whatever we're able to do, sooner or later we see a slight lifting of the fog and we can see bits and pieces of the town, the lights in the town, and we get a little bit of faith that actually I'm going the right direction. You know, it's true. And when we are in the presence of teachers like Lama Zopa Rinpoche, you really do see that that town can be reached. I mean, that's you know, so that's why I'm making this plug again, right? Is that it makes it real for us. You know, we see people like him. We see people like Mother Teresa. We see people like whoever inspires you, right? So it makes it real for us. So that's how one gains the self-confidence that we can make it. We have the potential, no matter how much in the depths of the mud we think, or the muck we think we are in. Not we are, but we are in, right? Just like the lotus flower, you know, that's the reason the lotus is used as a symbol in Buddhism and all of, you know. The lotus flower is a beautiful thing that grows out of the muck of the pond, right? So like that, our lotus, the Buddha nature, can also flower, right? So we can have that. So being in the presence of people like Rinpoche, beings like Rinpoche, gives one, you know, anyway, thank you for. Oh, so for next time, if you could please read the. There's a reading. You know, His Holiness Dalai Lama has in the readings of this for this module. The first one is a teaching by His Holiness about the eight verses. Actually, just so happens, the eight verses for thought transformation. Right. So if you could read that, and if you feel inspired, actually the other readings are not very long, so if you feel inspired, you can read the other ones too, you know, the Mahayana Thought Transformation by Rinpoche, and then What to Do When Problems Come, which we will also talk about, right? So, and I'll see you next week. Thank you for coming. Oh, I didn't ask it. Do you have any questions? I didn't ask any for any questions. I ran out of time. It's a good way of not having questions, I guess. Sister. Okay, well, hold them till next time if you don't want to be late now. So please remember them, write them down, and ask me next time. And I apologize.